This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran says it's holding expert-level meetings to review Washington's response to Tehran's amendments to the EU proposal for the revival of the JCPOA. British teachers and charities warn that widespread hunger will be the biggest challenge facing schools in England as children get ready to return to classrooms. Plus, Colombia's new ambassador arrives in the Venezuelan capital as the two countries restore full diplomatic relations following a three-year break. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. A top story this hour, Iran says it has under expert review the U.S.'s latest positions on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says it will offer its verdict once meetings reach a conclusion. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says no timetable can be set for Iran's feedback. He reiterated Iran's seriousness in the talks to revive the JCPOA, adding that Tehran has so far acted responsibly. Earlier this week, Washington gave its response to Iran's amendments to an EU proposal. The EU has called Iran's stance reasonable. The deal was thrown into chaos when the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Since last year, Iran and the remaining signatories have held multiple rounds of talks to revive the accord, with the U.S. indirectly involved. Iran has been demanding a strong, durable deal that guarantees its interests. In the UK, as children get ready to return to classrooms, teachers and charities warn that widespread hunger will be, quote, the single biggest challenge facing schools. The challenge has led to calls for the government to introduce universal free school meals. Charities are angry that the threshold for free school meals has not changed since 2018, despite soaring inflation. According to a charity group, 800,000 children living in poverty in England miss out on free school meals despite cost of living struggles of families. That number is expected to rise. Schools are also facing other challenges. The president of the National Association of Head Teachers says some schools may have problems to keep the lights on. The new revelation comes amid reports that inflation in the UK is already at a 40-year high of more than 10%. Hashtag Trending has taken a look at reactions to rising energy bills in the UK.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, your host Ali Reza. The coming winter may not be a particularly cozy time for many people in Europe, least of all in the UK, where the outgoing government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson just nearly doubled energy prices for households. The UK's energy bills are set to jump 80% to an average of £3,549 or $4,188 per year from October. That is according to regulator Ofgem, which describes the situation as a crisis. It is a rise that is significant even by the standards of a continent at war. While it has been Ukraine doing the actual fighting, Europe has been paying the bills. The UK in particular has been pretty generous with Ukraine, training its soldiers, offering it sophisticated weaponry, paying it cash. The British people, though, it seems, deserve less. And the British people aren't too happy about that. So let's check out some of the reactions on Twitter. Let's see what they've been talking about, this energy crisis that has been sweeping Europe and the UK in particular. Brexit Buster tweeted, "Anyone else heartily fed up being lectured by arrogant Tory hypocrites who have never missed a meal or gone cold in their entire pampered privileged lives, asking for millions of ordinary folk facing destitution this winter?" Ocean Jasper tweeted, "I'm currently in the USA and all news channels are using the UK as an example of how not to manage an economy. absolutely slating our inability to handle utility prices and inflation with no real PM at the wheel. She's, of course, referring to the resignation of Boris Johnson, which has resulted in him only acting as a caretaker prime minister. So our next tweet comes from Carol Adal. Life's simple pleasures taken away. Sea swimming polluted. Eating food banks. Heating energy crisis. Healthcare NHS crisis. Driving fuel crisis. Holidays cost of living crisis. I have never seen such a rapid decline in standards of living. Tories have done this to us. Felix has our next tweet. Why haven't the energy companies been asked to rein in their profits, endure some pain to beat Putin? People have been especially angry at the evocation by British officials of the war in Ukraine, blaming everything on the war and not taking any sort of accountability on themselves. Now, this next tweet is a tweet by Husey, which envisioned a conversation with the Tories, and it goes something like this. Tories, do you know there's a war on? Us, yes, you lot against the ordinary, decent, and hardworking people of this country. Moving on to a comment by Hani. That's what happens when you disrupt the supply chain and wage foolish wars on Russia, Iran, China, Syria, etc. Can't blame the Europeans. They are mere chess pieces under the US's thumb, and the US has 28 plus pieces ready to sacrifice. Going back to Twitter, a tweet by Sarah reads, I'm sorry, but I do think it's disgraceful that Boris Johnson has found it within himself to fly to Ukraine to receive an award, but he couldn't work with his colleagues or be present in government to tackle the energy and hashtag cost of living crisis. Now, over here we have a parody account of Liz Truss, and a tweet by her reads, energy bills will be three times higher this winter than they were last winter. Next winter, they will be three times higher again. Great success. The energy companies owe me for this one. Hashtag cost of living crisis. The political decision to fund Ukraine's war with Russia has far-reaching consequences for the entirety of Europe. By effectively putting themselves on an economic war footing, all European governments, not just the UK, are plunging their citizens into misery. Europe is lurching into an energy crisis. German and French electricity prices keep climbing, hitting fresh records. Santiago Capital has our next tweet. Apparently, the same leaders who led Europe into energy crisis, South America into perpetual currency crisis, Japan into decades of no growth, and China into a demographic nightmare are now going to solve Triffin's dilemma and their USD problems. Our next tweet comes from Ricardo Capellin. The most stupid war in last centuries for Europe. European countries are going to spend $278 billion for the energy crisis, while the USA has increased by more than 50% its oil and gas exports and spent only $10.7 billion in Ukraine for arms, which subsidizes the military industry. And our final comment comes from Said Mohammad Marandi. Iran is ready to help with the energy crisis if the U.S. provides Iran with a reasonable response. Large quantities of Iranian oil, as well as some Iranian natural gas, can enter European markets within weeks. There isn't much time before winter hits Europe and North America. That's a wrap for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Welcome back. Cabin crew members of a low-cost Spanish airline have started a 10-day strike for higher wages. 8 Iberia Express flights were canceled on Sunday alone.
We want a decent salary revision. Our salaries have been frozen since 2015. Here we are only a small part because people are still flying due to a very high minimum service. So we are here. We are only a small voice of a large collective.
A total of 92 flights are expected to be grounded, affecting more than 17,000 passengers. Iberia Express said in a statement it had arranged alternative flights or transport for 84% of affected passengers. The rest asked for a refund or vouchers. The walkout was called by the Spanish trade union, USO, in protest at stalled contract negotiations. Inflation in Spain hit 10.8% in July, prompting unions to call for a salary increase. In recent months, several European countries have experienced strikes over pay, working conditions, and soaring cost of living. Gas and electricity prices have risen to historic highs in Italy, with businesses complaining energy bills have gone up 10 times compared to last year. As Max Civilli reports from Rome, thousands of Italian businesses risk going bankrupt in the coming months.
Italy's energy crisis keeps getting more worrying by the day as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Italy, like most of its European neighbors, has reviewed its energy strategy following the start of the war in Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia, Rome's largest gas supplier, accounting for over 40% of imports. In an attempt to diversify its gas supplies, Rome has sealed new deals with Algeria and has planned the construction of new gas infrastructures, a move that includes buying more LNG and setting up new regasification plants.
Italy relies on fossil gas for 40% of its electricity production, with the consequence that electricity costs have gone crazy. Our industrial system relies very much on gas-produced electricity. The risk is that the products of our steelmakers and of our manufacturers will soon be out of the market.
Italy's industrial lobby Confindustria has warned of the risk of widespread company failures if energy prices keep surging this way. Confindustria is calling on the government to create a plan for rationing gas and to provide new subsidies to shield manufacturers. Gas prices have recently climbed to over 320 euros per megawatt hour, three times the price recorded at the beginning of July, and about 1,000% more compared to the same period a year ago. Businesses have slammed the rate as unsustainable, while consumer groups have described it as an emergency.
The impact on the average Italian will be dramatic. I expect a profound reshape of our lives and energy future.
In less than a month, Italy will return to the polls, with a large number of electors expected to skip the vote. According to latest polls, 16 million Italians, accounting for 35% of Italy's 51 million voters, will not cast their ballot as, quote, the trust in politician is wearing thin. Max Civili, Rome.
EU foreign policy chief says a proposed visa ban for all Russians planning to travel to the bloc is unlikely to be unanimously backed by member states. Josep Borrell made the remarks as EU foreign ministers are expected to discuss the issue later this week. Borrell said he is not in favor of stopping delivering visas to all Russians. He added that cutting EU's relationship with Russian civilians would not be helpful. Some EU members have demanded collective action to stop all Russians from traveling to the EU on tourist visas by freezing 2007 visa facilitation agreement with Moscow. The ban is intended to be a punishment for Russia for the war on Ukraine. Earlier this month, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged Western countries to impose a blanket travel ban on Russians. Kremlin says any attempt to isolate Russia or Russians has no prospect of success. Venezuela and Colombia have restored full diplomatic relations, which were cut off for 3 years. The new Colombian ambassador is now in the Venezuelan capital. Armando Benedetti said relations between the two South American countries should never have been severed, as they are brothers. Earlier, Colombia and Venezuela had appointed envoys to each other's capitals as part of their plan to reboot relations. Bogota and Caracas have also agreed to fully reopen the border between the two countries. Colombia's newly elected leftist president, Gustavo Petro, had promised to improve ties with its neighbor. Under the former right-wing Colombian president, the two countries' relations had turned sour. The UN Security Council has in the past years convened many times to discuss whether or not to give Palestine full membership. And now Palestinians are saying they want a vote again. The move, however, comes amid U.S. objections to Palestine becoming a full member of the world body.
The Palestinian Authority has renewed its push for full membership at the United Nations amid long-time acts of obstructionism and opposition by the United States. Any application for full membership at the UN would need approval from the Security Council, and that means the U.S. participation. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN says he has been consulting with Security Council members over a possible full membership bid over the past weeks. But the US, a full-fledged supporter of the occupying Israeli regime and a UNSC member with a veto power, on the other hand, has once again reiterated its opposition to the move, saying it will block it. the U.S.'s reason behind rejection of the Palestinians' push for membership. It should only occur after the resolution of an agreement for a two-state solution. But the real reason behind the U.S.'s opposition to Palestine's move is that membership would mean full international recognition of Palestine as an independent country on the international stage. In other words, Palestinian statehood, and that would be consequential for Israel. Yet the U.S. is at much fault for Palestinian situation, as is Israel. PA's ambassador to the UN has said, given that the peace process has been frozen for 8 years and that there is no initiative on the table, the issue of full UN membership should move forward.
Well, the United States provides $3.8 billion of military aid to the Israeli occupation every year on an annual basis. So what this means is that the United States is a full partner in all of the war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetrated by the Israeli regime. And this has been the case for decades upon decades. I mean, throughout the nearly 75 years of Nakba against the Palestinian people, the United States and other imperialist powers like Britain and France and Germany have been full partners with the occupation and these crimes against the Palestinian people. I mean, Palestinians have the right not only to full representation and recognition at the United Nations, but more importantly and fundamentally for the liberation of all of Palestine. And, you know, really what we need to be talking about is kicking Israel, kicking the Zionist regime out of the United Nations, not just recognizing Palestine.
In 2012, Palestine was granted non-member status, but this was done in the General Assembly, where no member has veto power. And now this has raised the assumption that Palestine may be following the same path to gain full membership. The Palestinian Authority's push comes just several weeks ahead of the UN General Assembly, where world leaders are set to convene in New York for their annual summit.
138 UN member states and two non-member states recognize Palestine as a state. Palestine has also been a non-member observer state of the UN General Assembly. Among the G20 countries, nine recognize Palestine, and others have conditioned the recognition to negotiations with Israel. This is where the U.S. role comes to the fore. Past experience shows the U.S. has not acted successfully in its role as a mediator. And that does it for this edition of World News. Thank you for your company. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Republic of Iran, which is one of the world's leading countries in medicine, high-tech industries, and other sciences, is ready to share its know-how and technology with African countries. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading, Iran's Initiative for Reviving Ties with Africa. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Iranian foreign minister's trip to African countries heralds a new phase in the Islamic Republic's ties with sub-Saharan Africa, which should help boost economic and political relationships. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, on the first phase of his three-leg trip, visited Muslim-majority Mali, which recently forced the French occupation troops to leave its soil after several years of creating violence and instability. The next phase of his four-day trip took him to Tanzania and Zanzibar in East Africa, which traditionally has enjoyed excellent relations with Iran. His high-ranking political and economic delegation included the representatives of several private sector companies. Recently, Mali had called for an urgent meeting at the UN Security Council to present evidence of France supporting terrorist groups on its soil. France has been a destabilizing force in West Sahara by its interventionist policies in the region and also by arming terrorist and militant groups. With the rise of anti-French sentiments in Mali and several demonstrations against the presence of French military, the ex-colonial force was forced to end its unwanted presence. Abdullahian, during his visit, said both Iran and Mali are of the opinion that instrumental application of terrorism should be set aside and countries be allowed to act independently. The Iranian foreign minister, during his visit to Tanzania, addressing the Iran-Tanzania Business Forum in Dar es Salaam, said, "Tanzania is one of the most important countries in Africa and has always had a special place in Iran's foreign policy. The people and officials of the two countries have a positive view toward each other." The three African nations, that is Mali, Tanzania, and Zanzibar, have all welcomed President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi's efforts to revive Tehran's traditional ties with Africa. There are vast fields for expansion of ties between Iran and the African countries in the commercial, defense, political, cultural, health, and technological fields. This is indeed a good development. It is hoped that other African countries would follow Mali's model and force the French and all other former European colonial forces from their soil. Of course, sub-Saharan Africa ought to be vigilant of American designs, which are also more dangerous and have the poisonous Zionist tail attached to them. The Islamic Republic of Iran, which is one of the world's leading countries in medicine, high-tech industries, and other sciences, is ready to share its know-how and technology with African countries.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Raza, peace be upon him, narrates that his illustrious ancestor, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, when asked by a person on the rights of the father upon the son, said, "He should not call his father by name. He should not walk ahead of him. He should not sit until his father has seated himself. And he should not do such acts as a result of which people abuse his father."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we're talking about the charitable nature of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Now, as we're talking about the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam, I would like to report to you a short story that took place during his time that shows that His Eminence Al-Imam Al-Hussein was really a charitable person. A traveler came to Al-Imam Al-Hussein and saluted him and told him about his needs and said, "I have heard from your grandfather that he used to say, whenever you have any need, ask it from me. Ask it from one of the four persons, from a noble Arab or the benevolent or the charitable who gives happily, or the people of Quran, or one having an elegant face. However, the Arab has received nobility only through your grandfather. And as for benevolence, it is your custom. And as for the Quran, it was revealed in your house. An elegant face, I heard the messenger of Allah say, when you desire to see me, just look at the faces of Hassan and Hussein." Trying to say that he really sees so many good qualities in Al-Imam Al-Hussein. Now, His Eminence Imam Hussein asked him, "What do you want?" The traveler wrote his requirement on the sand, and His Eminence Imam Hussein said, "I heard my father say that goodness is proportionate to divine recognition. So I want to ask you three questions. If you reply to one of them, I shall give you one third of what I have. If you reply two questions, two thirds of what I possess shall be yours. If you reply to all three questions, all I have shall be yours, while a pass has just arrived from Iraq." So the traveler said, "Go on and ask the questions. There is no power and strength except from Allah. We'll come back in a few minutes and I'll complete the story. Thank you for listening."
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله
وعلى
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And now, we are talking about the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam, and we were reporting about a short story that took place during his time, whereby a traveler came to Imam al-Hussein and asked for his help. Now, Imam al-Hussein just told him to answer a few questions and he will help him whatever he needs. In fact, he will give him half or even all of his wealth if he continues and answer the questions. Now, when he was asked the questions, the traveler said, "Go on and ask the questions. There's no power and strength except from Allah." The Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked the traveler, "What is the best deed?" Then the traveler answered, "Believe in God. If you have a belief in God, that's the best deed that you can do." Then Imam asked him, "What is the way of salvation for any man, for a man?" Then the traveler answered, "The reliance and having trust on God." And then Imam asked him, "What is that bestows beauty to man?" The man replied, "Knowledge accompanied with forbearance." "What if he does not have? What if he does not have knowledge?" That is, Imam asked him. "Then he should have wealth accompanied with generosity." "What if he does not have it? What if he doesn't have the wealth?" "Then he should have penury accompanied with patience." He said, "What if he does not have that also? A bolt of lightning should strike him from the sky and burn him up." The holy Imam smiled and handed him the pass. He gave him what he needed just by asking him a few questions, and the guy answered them very nicely. This is a short story showing us the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. Dear brothers and sisters, we really can learn a lot from the life of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. We see how charitable he was and how he lived with people. Some of them, he didn't even know who they were. They just came to him, seeked for help, and he helped them. This is how Aba Abdullah lived with people. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until next episode, inshallah, fi amanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Living through a pandemic is strange, as we are often locked indoors. But a UK-based Indian mechanical engineer made the best use of his time during the coronavirus lockdown and built an airplane. 38-year-old Ashok Ali Serial, who is also a private pilot, had long dreamt of a personal aircraft. He initially planned to order an aircraft kit and built it with his colleagues. But he says the 2020 lockdown left him with no choice but to complete it on his own. Now he has an aircraft which he has named after his youngest daughter, Dia. The plane can carry up to 4 people, including the pilot, and fly about 250 kilometers an hour. After getting clearance to fly, he flew across 4 European countries with his friends. He has also gone on a trip with his family of 4. You might think twice about throwing out your old trainers after this story. A startup in Tunisia breathes new life into old shoes as artists restore and even customize the footwear. The new business is called Kenenti and is located in the capital, Tunis. Here, the team uses fabrics, laces and leather recovered from various factories for the repair work. The creative artists work on every detail during each project, even the soles of the shoes. The work aims to find solutions to shoe waste and reuse items instead of adding them to the world's landfills. Cherif Zeroui is the co-founder of Kenenti. He says the idea came to him 2 years ago when he discovered the number of shoes thrown away each year in Tunisia.
In France, there were 100 million pairs of shoes thrown away every year. This is a huge figure for us, and for the ecosystem and for the earth. In Tunisia, it's almost the same given the population. There were 3 or 4 million shoes thrown away every year. So we thought of giving added value to these shoes, so we restored them.
Zerbui also says he is happy to create jobs for those willing to participate regardless of the educational degree. Besides shoes, these artists dabble in restoring worn-out handbags, giving them a brand new look. Many of the artists and interns say they are proud to be part of this unique project. They say they feel like a family there. The startup is the first trainer restoration business to be launched in North America.
A age does not matter. It's the heart that counts. A Guatemalan female footballer has proved that there is no point one should worry about the age. 57-year-old Alma Salazar has a passion for soccer and takes care of her team's goalpost. Known as Flying Granny, she launches herself and deflects a ball that's looking for the nets. The passion for the sport was born when she was 19 years old. She started training with a men's team where she often found a place as a goalkeeper. Since then, Alma has played for several professional and amateur football clubs. In her room that overlooks a local stadium, Alma keeps trophies she has won on a table, most of them as the least defeated goalkeeper. Locals praise her as an unbeatable goalkeeper. The evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The four-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured three major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing. An inflatable building that explores how people would potentially live on Mars has been unveiled in the British city of Bristol. It's a two-story structure with an area of 570 square feet, powered by solar panels. It's designed to cope with temperatures as low as minus 63 degrees Celsius. Although the Martian house will be displayed above ground, its lower level will be fully buried to maximize protection against the harsh environment on Mars. Inside, the top floor features a hydroponic living room filled with decorative plants that feed into a circular wastewater system. A team of experts helped develop the design, taking into consideration the complexity of transporting materials to the red planet and what is already there.
So in the gold inflatable structure which you see above you, that's the main living space of the Martian house. It's gold to reflect dangerous solar rays and cosmic radiation, and it's inflatable because it would be filled with a special concrete made of the dust and water that you find on Mars, again to protect you from those dangerous solar and cosmic rays.
The Martian house was envisioned by local artists 7 years ago. The artists also brought together space scientists, architects, engineers, designers, and even school children. The space-age dwelling explores what a house on Mars could be like and is meant for research and experiments about the future. The major objective of the project, however, is to provoke questions about living more sustainably with the resources at hand here on Earth.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Japanese plastic food artisans are showcasing their mouth-watering artificial creations at an exhibition in Japan's capital city, Tokyo. From the Leaning Tower of Pizza to fish slicing and cooking, or even the quirky stacked pancakes, you can find almost everything at the exhibit. Other sculptures, including a deep-fried shrimp, with full-breaded legs scaling a mountain of shredded cabbage like a tiger. Another creation on display is a Tetris game made of chicken. Plastic food artists get really excited for the exhibition each year as they are given a chance to practice their own spin on creativity, bringing food to life with curious characters.
So normally we have to follow orders from clients. We take their views on board when we're making items. Normally that's our work. But for the competition, you can use your imagination. How it finally ends up is totally up to you. I like that aspect of it.
There are some 60 sculptors on display. Some are silly, but others highlight the artist's skills. The models were made with the same careful detail as the rock-solid noodle soups and crispy-looking plastic snacks on display outside Japanese restaurants. There is a lucrative business for them in Japan.
Deforest management plays a key role in mitigating climate change. Like many world countries, China has accelerated environmental and social structural changes in urban spaces to deal with this pertinent issue. The Donggu Forest Park is one such project that has provided city dwellers enough space to breathe. It comes into being from what local people usually called rotten woods. The park on the northern bank of the Xialinge River covers an area of nearly 120 hectares. Nobody would come there before, as the place was full of flies and mosquitoes. But now, with the environment improved and water cleaned in the river, the place has turned into a wonderland, attracting locals and even foreign tourists.
Now the sky is blue, the water clean and the air fresh, with green greeting you wherever you go. The elderly play Tai Chi or do bodybuilding exercises here. Young people play football, basketball and table tennis.
Over the past 20 years, a large number of cities in China have undergone a brief but rapid urban expansion. Most of these cities are now facing social problems such as an aging population and a high prevalence of chronic diseases. A comprehensive environmental improvement program in the area was initiated in 2014 in order to create space for those who want to take a break from their everyday works.
Whilst not being as painful as a broken limb, animals like humans suffer from chronic and acute pain from gum infections, broken teeth, and bacterial spread through the circulation. A 16-year-old elephant in Pakistan is one such case. Madhubala, suffering for years from a dental infection caused by a broken tusk, has finally got relief thanks to vets, dentists. Named after a legendary Indian actress, Madhubala's eyes were taped shut, her legs tied to support her during sedation and subsequent treatment at a Karachi zoo. The vets had to use drills and other heavy surgical tools to extract the infected tusk. She is one of four African elephants being treated in Karachi by an eight-member team from Global Animal Welfare Group, Four Paws. A Pakistani court last year asked Four Paws to assess the health of the animals after local animal rights activists raised concerns about their well-being. England's Paradise Wildlife Park welcomes its new guest, an endangered red panda cub. The mother, Tilly, gave birth to the cub just 1 month after she lost her breeding partner, Nampang. Experts say Tilly had been under a breeding project for 4 years. The cub has been named Little Red, and his birth is being celebrated as a, quote, symbol of hope. Red pandas are classed as an endangered species and are on the red list of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The bushy-tailed bamboo munchers dwell in high-altitude Asian forests, and their population is now fewer than 2,500. Lightning strikes are very powerful and misunderstood force of nature that we all often see being used in films. A spectacular lightning strike has illuminated the sky over the Scottish town of Dundee. A video from an eyewitness that captured the hypnotic scene has been shared on several social media platforms. The lightning in the clip can be seen sending several bolts in opposite directions. Below, a church spire is silhouetted against the lightning flashes. But lightning is not always spectacular, as sometimes it causes fire to tower and high rises. Last month, a wind turbine caught fire after being struck by a lightning bolt in North Texas, United States. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Some commentators think US Democrats have moved too far to the left, too far from the so-called center. We now present you an article written by Robert Reich, a former US Secretary of Labor and a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Republican Party is Terrible, so why may Democrats lose to them this year?" Much of today's Republican Party is treacherous and treasonous. So why are Democrats facing midterm elections that, according to most political observers, they're likely to lose? Having been a loyal Democrat for some 70 years, including a stint as a cabinet secretary, it pains me to say this. The Democratic Party has lost its way. Some commentators think Democrats have moved too far to the left, too far from the so-called centre. But this is utter rubbish. Where's the centre between democracy and authoritarianism? And why would Democrats want to be there? Others think President Biden hasn't been sufficiently angry or outraged. But what good would that do? After 4 years of Donald Trump, why would anyone want more anger and outrage? The real failure of the Democratic Party is its loss of the American working class. As Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg concluded after the 2016 presidential election, Democrats don't have a white working class problem. They have a working class problem, which progressives have been reluctant to address honestly or boldly. The fact is that Democrats have lost support with all working class voters across the electorate. The working class used to be bedrock of the Democratic Party, but what happened? During the first 2 years of the Clinton, Obama, and Biden administrations, when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, they purportedly scored some victories for working families. For example, the Affordable Care Act, an expanded earned income tax credit, and the Family and Medical Leave Act. But they also allowed the middle class to hollow out and the working class to sink. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton passed free trade agreements without providing millions of blue-collar workers who consequently lost their jobs a means of getting new ones that paid at least as well. His North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, and plan for China to join the World Trade Organization undermined the wages and economic security of manufacturing workers across America, hollowing out vast swathes of the Rust Belt. Bill Clinton also deregulated Wall Street. This led to the financial crisis of 2008, in which Barack Obama bailed out the biggest banks and bankers, but did nothing for homeowners, many of whom owed more on their homes than their homes were worth. Barack Obama didn't demand as a condition for the bailout that banks refrain from foreclosing on underwater homeowners. Nor did Obama demand an overhaul of the banking system. Instead, he allowed Wall Street to water down attempts at re-regulation. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama stood by as corporations hammered trade unions. They failed to reform labor laws to allow workers to form unions with a simple up or down majority vote, or even to impose meaningful penalties on companies that violated labor protections. Joe Biden has supported labor law reform but hasn't fought for it, leaving the protecting the right to organize act to die inside his ill-fated Build Back Better Act. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama allowed antitrust enforcement to ossify, enabling large corporations to grow far larger and major industries to become more concentrated. Joe Biden claims he is trying to revive antitrust enforcement, but hasn't made it a centerpiece of his administration. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama depended on big money from corporations and the wealthy. Both turned their backs on campaign finance reform. Barack Obama was the first presidential nominee since Richard Nixon to reject public financing in his primary and general election campaigns, and he never followed up on his re-election promise to pursue a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United versus FEC, the 2010 Supreme Court opinion opening the floodgates to big money in American politics. Joe Biden has tried to supposedly regain the trust of the working-class Americans, but Democratic lawmakers, most obviously and conspicuously Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have blocked measures that would have lowered the cost of childcare, the cost of elder care, prescription drugs, healthcare and education. They've blocked a higher minimum wage and paid family leave. Yet neither Senator Joe Manchin nor Senator Kyrsten Sinema nor any other Democrat who has failed to support Biden's agenda has suffered any consequences. Why hasn't Biden done more to rally the working class and build a coalition to grab back power from the emerging oligarchy? Presumably for the same reasons that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama didn't. The Democratic Party continues to prioritize the votes of suburban swing voters who supposedly determine electoral outcomes. And it still depends on money from big corporations and the wealthy. The most powerful force in American politics today is anti-establishment fury at a rigged system. There is no longer a left or a right. There is no longer a moderate center in American politics. And the real choice is either Republican authoritarian populism or Democratic progressive populism. Democrats cannot defeat authoritarian populism without an agenda of radical democratic reform, a pro-democracy, anti-establishment movement. Democrats must stand squarely on the side of working people against oligarchy. They must form a united coalition of people of all races, of all genders and classes to unrig the system. Trumpism is not the cause of our divided nation. It is the symptom of a rigged system that was already dividing us.
American immigrant family.
Part 2.
It has been almost 5 months since Yusuf has been imprisoned, awaiting his deportation hearing. It is now just 2 days away. Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, tries to remain hopeful.
Yusuf's trial is held in the Chrome Jail in the swamps outside Miami. ICE has flown in a team of four lawyers to try the case. Yusuf's lawyer, Charles Cook, has agreed to take the case for free. No cameras are allowed inside.
We are currently in the second day of the trial. We just finished the testimony of the government's first witness, both his cross-examination and his direct examination. What's at stake is what young Muslim men in America can do and act like in America today. The reality here is, if you're a Muslim in America, you can't think like everybody else. You can't think like your colleagues. I have another client that we went to lunch with a few weeks ago who's about the same age as Yusuf. And I was telling him about Yusuf's case, and it was very interesting what he said. He had very little sympathy for Yusuf. He said, what is he thinking in America as a Muslim man? You can't go surfing on the internet, look at sites. You can't hang around with other people that are Muslims and talk about Islam. And I frankly find that sad.
David Cole is a law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an expert in constitutional and First Amendment rights. He says that the targeting of immigrants in America is nothing new.
Historically, whenever the United States has faced a security threat, it has responded by targeting immigrants with its most restrictive measures. And I think that's partly because it's easy to do so. You know, it's one thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat. You've got to sacrifice some of your liberties and rights in order to protect the country. But it's another thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat, but we're going to give you more.